Hello and welcome. Conversations is coming to you today from the Brisbane Writers' Festival at the State Library of Queensland on the banks of the Brisbane River. Kelly Sue DeConnick and Matt Fraction are both comic book writers. They work for Marvel Comics, and between them, they've been entrusted with the lives of the Avengers, the X-Men, Spider-Man, Iron Man, and Thor. Right now, Kelly Sue DeConnick is writing Captain Marvel, who used to be Ms. Marvel until Kelly Sue upgraded her pay grade and gave her a new costume. Captain Marvel is one of the most cosmically powerful individuals in the Marvel Universe, and one of her favourite things to do is to fly right up to the edge of space and then topple back down to Earth, because you'd do that if you were Captain Marvel. Matt Fraction writes Hawkeye, who's not cosmically powerful and has to live off his wits and skill. He's the guy with the bow and arrow from the Avengers movie. You might remember him. The stories in Hawkeye are actually... getting a bit of publicity for his own title there. Gosh, the stories in Hawkeye are based around his downtime, what he's doing when he's not with the Avengers. I actually think it can be said that comics are one of the great American pop culture creations of the 20th century, along with jazz, rock and roll, and the movies. They've got a distinctive language and rhythm, and the blend of arts and motion and text can show you things that books and films just can't. Matt and Kelly Sue both love the medium, which is just as well that they have this in common, because they are a married couple. Matt and Kelly Sue, welcome, and please welcome our guests as well, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. I know you both love comics. You need to, of course, to work in the medium. What is beautiful about the medium for you, Kelly Sue?
I like that. I like the relationship that the reader has to the page, that you can control the rate at which you consume the story, different from a movie or a television show where you're not, all of that is sort of, you're a passive consumer. The consumer of a comic book is active. You can go backwards. You can, you could read it back to front if you chose. You could really linger on a page or a panel. You can spend as much time with it as you want as you consume that narrative. And I also love that it, in superhero comics specifically, that there's a real lizard brain kind of thing happening there. I think it's they are related to some of my other favorites, which are opera I love, and commedia dell'arte, and melodrama. These things that I think have a way of communicating to us the human experience, like Greek mythology, in a way that's more direct somehow than pure naturalism.
But when you're writing, one of the lovely things about comics is that they can really surprise you much more than a book can with a single startling image. That's something you're conscious of, the way where the panel sits when something sudden happens. You have to read a sentence to be surprised by it in a novel, but a single image can just have that instant power of surprise and revelation, can't it?
Yeah, there's something specific about the way our minds process language, where you've got your word and picture, but they have to be kind of overlapped, and they sort of form a third data stream, and that's something that's so singular and unique to comics, that the right turn of phrase, the right repetition of image and size and scale, we experience time in image is represented by space, and it's all kinds of really great brain stretching things when you really get into the theory of how it works and how our brains process it. It's really unlike anything else.
And the power of the page turn, which is the thing that we have to think about as we're moving into more and more digital comics, that page turn isn't necessarily, depending, like if you're doing the scrolling web comics or different ways that it's done where it's revealed panel by panel, or it's really forcing us to think about it differently. And there's pluses and minuses, things I'll regret losing, but new things that are coming as well.
So one of those big shock reveal things nearly always happens on the turn of the page, doesn't it?
Right.
So
absolutely.
The action's tripping along, it's happening, and then you turn the page and bang,
Yeah, 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 small panel, you got your pace set up, page turn, splash.
Does that mean sometimes you have to have a whole lot of filler so you can get to the end of that page to get to the page turn?
I never end up. I'm always going the opposite direction where it's like, I've too few pages always.
Superheroes dominate Hollywood at the moment, and of course, can dominate the global imagination through Hollywood at the moment. And a lot of people love this, a lot of people hate it. Nonetheless, it seems to say something about the way we live our lives now, Matt. Why are these things, superheroes, things that were created in the 1930s and the 1960s, working so well right now in the culture.
You mean heroic fables created in the shadow of global fascism? It's interesting, isn't it, that it would that stories of morality and kindness and goodness resonate with us right now in this cultural moment. I'm being a little snarky, but I kind of mean it. I think the rise of fascism in Europe in the 30s, we needed it, and I think now the headlines keep getting worse, and I think there's a resonance with people standing up and doing the right thing. It's nice to remind us that we're capable of that as a species when we're capable of doing so many other horrible things. You know, I just read this morning, apparently there's no more email encryption anywhere. Like, oh great, it got worse. Even today, it keeps getting worse. Just when you think, surely we've reached the bottom of this barrel of miserable stuff, something bleaker happens. And so I think now, as much as we needed it in the 30s, we need to remind ourselves the goodness of which we are capable. And I think these fables and these myths and these legends, there's a reason why people still read the Odyssey. There's a reason why the Greeks remain the kind of bedrock of narrative, at least amongst Western-speaking, however we want to classify that. It speaks to our capabilities and our potential so much, with so much grace and so much elegance, that it can appear frivolous.
What about the idea of the empowered individual, Kelly Sue? Because, you know, really we don't achieve any big things all on our own in this world. We need to do it with a huge network of other people, and great big scientific discoveries, you know, are always done by not just one person now. It's always done by a gigantic, you know, college of human beings. But superheroes are the empowered single individual who makes change.
Yes and no.
What's the no bit?
Yeah, I mean, I think, Elizabeth Warren had a really fantastic quote recently when she was talking about...
U.S. Senator, Elizabeth Warren?
I'm butchering her quote, but she was talking about how you know, yes, you built this factory and you made all these jobs, and good for you, and you should be able to keep a good portion of the money that was earned. But you know, you also brought your goods to market on roads that we all paid for, you know, and so on and so forth. And you know, your workers were educated in a public system that we all paid for. And you know, this is we are all. It is a community, whether you choose to believe it or not. Right. And I think that Carol Danvers is extraordinarily gifted.
This is Captain Marvel.
She's a Kree human hybrid.
Are you the first person to ever say the word Kree on national radio in Australia?
I think I am the very first person to refer to the alien race of the Kree in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, I get the key to the city for that, I think. she is an extraordinarily powerful woman, but
there's a guy that puts gas in the plane.
But there's specifically her, you know, Tracy is her kind of old crotchety Obi-Wan, and Wendy, who does all the paperwork, and you know,
the monomyth. There's a lot of support characters in the monomyth.
I just read an issue of Captain Marvel where she and Spider-Woman both wrestle these two dinosaurs who appear in the city for no apparent reason. But there's going to be hundreds of people who have to clean up that mess at the end of it, aren't there?
Yes. And you know what? I'm very proud of this for some reason, but afterwards I always make Carol sign a waiver. Like, there's always a scene where some dude comes up to her with a clipboard and she has to sign, like, yes, I'm responsible for this. Because you know that dude exists. That's like the most powerful guy in the Marvel Universe is the dude who carries the clipboard that's like, hey, yo, Iron Man, I need you to sign this.
Dwayne McDuffie had a whole book about it called Damage Control, and they were the guys that went around and cleaned up after the mess.
After superheroes. Yeah. The very first superhero was, of course, Superman, created in 1938 by Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, two young Jewish guys living in Cleveland, Ohio. I think they were teenagers when they created Superman, very, very probably. Matt, what kind of an archetype is Superman? He looks to me like Moses, actually.
Right. He's a very, very Judeo-Christian, you know, baby in a basket has come here to redeem and save us and lead us to the promised land, right?
Moses parts the Red Sea, you know, Superman leaps over tall buildings.
Jerry Siegel's dad was killed in a petty holdup. He was a tailor, and three stick-up artists robbed his dad's shop and shot him dead.
The Batman origin, though.
I know, right?
That's weird.
It gets better. It's even more twisted. But you know, he was a kid that needed a hero. He was a kid that you know, and there was a sort of fitness was very much in vogue at the time, and kind of the Jack LaLanne, you know, in just 7 days I can make you a man kind of thing, and physical fitness was very, all these kind of swirling things ended up, these two guys, these two little Jewish nerds in Ohio had the bottle that caught that lightning, and it changed the world for good or for ill. But these were the guys that got there first and best. And
the costume was like based on wrestling outfits of the
1930s. Right, exactly. It was like weightlifting costumes.
Yeah.
That's sort of like circus strongmen kind of stuff.
But they're a way of making, allowing a figure like Superman to appear like a Greek god. Like, you clearly can't have naked superheroes
running
around.
Yeah, but even still, like, it was a thing where like, but like he couldn't fly at first. He could just jump real far. You know, it was a very, very modest super, you know, and he was very, you know, you know, he worked for unions and stuff like that. Like, he was always looking out for, it was a very blue collar kind of origin story. It was very much two kids from Ohio telling, you know, stories about the evil as they understood it. Like, he could leap at least 17 feet. My gosh, that must be 4 meters. I just like,
and the cover of the very first Superman comic, Action Comics, he's lifting a car!
Yeah,
and everyone's going, my God!
Yeah, and there's a guy having a nervous breakdown. I've 1,800 pounds of... But yeah, it's a very modest... And it grows and grows. And then it became such a phenomenon. You had guys writing for radio and the comics and then the daily strip and the newspapers. And all of these different characters came from all of these different guys in a room and in different rooms. Sort of Jimmy Olsen was created over here and Heat Vision came from there. And, you know, all this kind of stuff gradually... But like that idea, that sort of... That Moses idea at the heart of Superman was like a magnet, and all these other kind of things kind of glommed onto it.
What does Clark Kent do for Superman as a character and his appeal, Kelly Sue?
Humanizes, I guess. I mean, and there's also the part of, you know, journalists or truth seekers, and that's a kind of heroism in and of itself, and very much so at the time. And I think that gives the other side of it, you know, and there's also the cliche that the, you know, superhero's real weakness isn't kryptonite, it's his heart, right? You know, that this is how you get to him, is through what he loves.
Well, Lois Lane adores Superman. Mm-hmm. Lois Lane is a prototypical feminist of the 1940s. She's a go-getter, she's got her own job, she's brave, she's got integrity, she adores Superman, and she's, early on, she's really quite contemptuous towards Clark Kent because he's timid and shy.
And Jerry liked her, but she married Joe. In real life, the real woman that modeled it was Jerry's girlfriend first, and she left him for Joe, and they got married.
I'm going to have a month to process that,
right,
I think,
okay,
in my own mind.
Just,
that's so intense.
It gets better.
That's
so weird.
Yeah. Are they playing out some...
They were. She was the model. They needed a model because they were you know, very young, 16, 17, and I'm jet-lagged, so I'm probably even transposing Jerry and Joe's names, and I apologize. But yeah, she was the model. She was the life model they used for Lois, and Jerry liked her, but she ended up with Joe.
Is there some kind of argument between Jerry and Joe being played out in the character of Lois Lane?
I think the idea that she would have contempt for the sensitive, wide-eyed, glasses-wearing writer who understands us all in such a way, if only we understood him and what he could give us. I don't know. Your guess is as good as mine, but if one wanted to just toss a theory off the top of your head...
You know what Quentin Tarantino's theory about Clark Kent is? He thinks it's Superman sneering at humanity because he wakes up in the morning.
No, that was Bill's. That's Bill's theory.
Well, yeah,
I don't think that's Tarantino. Was it Tarantino or was it Bill?
Yeah, well, it's in the Tarantino film. I think we can put this idea in his head. Superman wakes up every day not as Clark Kent but as Superman, and when he's impersonating humans, he's parodying us. Shy, sensitive, hopeless, bumbling, scared. We look hilarious to Superman. What do you think of that theory, guys? Let the record show that Kelly Sue DeConnick made the jerky motion there.
I always thought there would be a great comic of Clark Kent as a reporter, but as a reporter not being able to be Superman, just to follow the rules of what journalism works. And you can't just use your X-ray vision to read the files that you need to read.
You have to have four sources.
Yeah, like that kind of thing. Like how frustrating it would be for Clark Kent. Like I could just burn through the stupid wall with my eyes and take the stupid thing that I need. But no, I have to find three, you know, I have to follow the money. Like, imagine Clark Kent doing a Woodward and Bernstein thing. I can just hold Nixon upside down and shake him until the truth comes out. But no, I'm going to follow the money and read all of these pay stubs.
But I mean, I don't know. And I've never written Superman, so I'm sure it's fraught with all kinds of peril, but it just as a, like, Lois Lane is the only thing I've ever collected. I think that's true. That might not be true. I might be lying. But it is the first collection I can think of that I have.
Apparently we don't count shoes and purses.
Let the record show that Kelly... No. I love the idea that Clark Kent is human as much as any of us are human. I think, you know, he was raised in a small town by parents that loved him. He loves humanity with all that he's worth. He may not have been biologically our son, but he is our son. He is us. He is the best of us. I don't like the idea that he's contemptuous of anything. Quentin Tarantino makes some great films, but I disagree with him on this one.
But again, that was Bill. I don't think that. But that was the
Kill
bride's,
Bill, wasn't it?
That was
yeah.
the bride's argument. Yeah. Was your argument? That was the two of them. That
it's an argument, nonetheless. So this Superman who comes along as the first superhero. He's bright. He's gaudy. He's got a good costume. Everyone loves him. He's like President Eisenhower, I suppose, when you get to the 1950s, or General Eisenhower. And then a year later, Batman is invented, a completely different character, a character who becomes a superhero because his parents are shot dead in the street by a guy with a gun when he's a kid. And he spends the rest of his youth swearing vengeance on criminals, doesn't know what to do until a bat comes through the window and he goes, that's it, I'm going to terrify criminals. He's kind of like the exact polar opposite of Superman, Matt.
Right. He's the Dionysian opposite to
yeah, Superman's to, Apollo, and he's kind of
I find it's probably says everything you need to understand about the character that in response to losing your parents to violent crime, when a bat smashes through your window, you decide, I'm going to spend my fortune beating up poor people dressed like that. It is there's something so the sort of that vigilante underbelly to Batman has always been so. It's easy. I think, you know, comics do visual action so well and spectacle and prop. It's kind of easy to lose sight of, like, no, wait, he's beating up the mentally ill.
The thing I'm trying to
Joker needs Thorazine. Ativan, you're punching someone who's disturbed and needs help.
But they're not people; they're archetypes, aren't they? And the Joker is some idea. He's not quite human, isn't he? He's sort of anti-human in a way.
Is that the Conrad Veidt movie, The Man Who Laughs? He's got that sort of
that grin,
incredibly creepy.
Trying to recall why Batman appealed to me as a kid, I think it kind of summons all this kind of latent rage you might have as a child, and directs it towards justice or something else.
It's adolescence, isn't it? Like it's broody, and I think like there was a time when you know, at least with all of my peers, like there's very definitely like, you know, first you love the heart characters, first you love those that go up, you know, and then you hit adolescence and then like, oh God. And then you go into your cave just like Batman and you're surly and resentful and you spend a few years there and then you come back out again and then you find the appeal for those characters that go up again. I think it's part of the, you know, I'm being so contemptuous of Batman. I don't mean to be. I like Batman, all right. But there's something so he's so easy to make fun of because he's so broody
and humorless.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's just like, oh, come on. Yeah.
Hey, cool Penny. Thanks.
Yeah. So there's these DC characters, Superman, Batman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, and there's this golden age of comics in the 1940s. It peters out in the 1950s for all sorts of reasons. Then 1960 comes along, and two other Jewish guys, Stan Lee and Jack Kirby, create Marvel Comics. What's new with Marvel Comics? Why is Marvel Comics different? Who wants to take that on? Matt, do you want to try that one? Why is Marvel different? What new angle do they have on superheroes?
Well, they were sort of allowed to stay in existence because if they went away, DC or national publications would have had a monopoly and the government would have shut them down. So by the grace of National, they were allowed to stay in existence. And they were told you were allowed to publish 8 titles. So Martin Goodman, the guy who ran the company, fired everybody but his nephew Stan and went to Stan and said, good news, you're writing 8 comic books. And out came Stan and his partners, created what we now understand as, you know, an economic superpower known as Marvel Entertainment, basically. And Stan and Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko and John Romita and all these other creatives kind of created an entirely new universe of superheroes that were in diametric opposition with DC. As different as Superman is to Batman, so is Marvel to DC.
What was different about these guys? These new Spider-Man, the X-Men, Fantastic Four?
You know, DC was, from my, again, armchair perspective, kind of was being written by a bunch of science fiction writers, guys who wrote for the pulp. Even Alfred Bester wrote for DC for a while, and Julie Schwartz was a big editor at DC and a pulps editor, a science fiction guy. These were all kind of lofty science fiction writers that were kind of up here looking down. Jack Kirby punched his way out of the Lower East Side. These were guys that couldn't work anywhere else, and found themselves drawing comics. It was the only way they could make a living on their art, and they were in the gutters looking up. And Marvel heroes were neurotic. They were, as Alan Moore likes to say, they had 2 dimensions. I have to beat up the Green Goblin, and my aunt needs pills. We have to stop Dr. Doom from blowing up the Baxter Building, which we're being evicted from. But there became this quote, real world, unquote, underpinning to what the Marvel heroes were, where they were much more relatable. They weren't gods looking down on us and judging us either from their stately, you know, Wayne Manor, or, you know, planets. But, you know, Peter lived in Queens and the Fantastic Four had bills to pay and.
Spider-Man's the first superhero I can think of who's driven by shame. Right. Because his uncle, he lets,
it's the perfect origin. It's the perfect origin story.
Why?
You can't remove a single part of it without the rest of it becoming meaningless. Every part of it's why the Julie Taymor musical didn't work. It's why these stupid movies don't work. They keep trying to add bells and whistles. It's perfect. You don't need it. It's perfect. This thing happens, and as a result of his inaction, he loses the most important man in his life, and the rest of his life is driven by that mistake. I can never not be present again.
He's too selfish. This criminal runs past him. He goes, what's in it for me? I'm not going to catch him.
Right.
Then a day later, this guy is
this
the
guy
one who kills his
uncle.
Kill
his uncle. Right.
Kills his uncle.
Right. And if I would have stopped him, only I would have put my foot out and tripped him, the barest minimum of effort, I could have saved my uncle's life. But I didn't have to do anything spectacular. I didn't have to do anything heroic. All I had to do was stop a guy, and I was so selfish I couldn't do it. So the rest of his life is spent living. There's no, if he's ever relieved of that guilt, there is no reason for him to become Spider-Man.
Matt, you've written the X-Men, and the X-Men was something different too. The Avengers, they're adored, you know, the DC heroes are adored. The right. X-Men are hated. They're right. Actually hated because they're mutants. They're right. A different kind of human. They're homo superior. And what kind of reader identifies with the X-Men?
Everyone. Everyone that has ever felt out of place in any situation. And it's a great metaphor book. You can see yourself in these characters. You can, every show I do, literally every single show I do, someone comes up to me trembling slightly and with a quaver of emotion in their voice, thanks me for the stuff that I did on X-Men because it applied to them at that time in their life when they were reading. It's the most remarkable experience. But these are people who are rejected for being different and other and not of us and alien and strange and are hated and feared because of it, and yet they still do the right thing. And
they're Jewish, they're gay. It's the perfect metaphor for that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a very all access metaphor.
Yeah, I mean, there's an echo of that going back to Superman as well. That what child has not at some point imagined, you know, I am so different from everyone. Am I secretly a robot? You know, am I adopted? Am I alien? You know, I think we all have that moment of feeling like we don't belong as children because this world is so big and frightening and odd. And I think that the Superman as alien, and the X-Men as other really
Gels, doesn't it? Because the X-Men are hated for who they are. Legislated against. They're hated for who they are. And nonetheless, they're powerful and beautiful. And they're still going to be good people anyway, despite the fact that they're hated.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler. On air, online, and podcast.
Coming to you from the Brisbane Writers Festival today with two writers for Marvel Comics, Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick. They both write different characters. They've been married for some years together, which kind of makes it interesting. We'll get to that in a moment. Can we talk about Captain Marvel, which is the comic you write?
Yeah.
Kelly Sue.
Let's do.
Popular with people in the audience. She was once Ms. Marvel. You upgraded her pay scale, like I said. Tell me about the pleasure of writing a character like Carol Danvers, who's kind of a human who becomes this cosmically powerful human being.
I love it. I love her so much. She is she was a security officer. This is the part where non-comics readers sort of roll their eyes, but
there are more than a few of those listening to the program at the moment, so it's fine. I think
she was in the wrong place at the wrong time when a psyche magnetron exploded and it transferred the powers of Marvel through to Carol Danvers' body, and for a little while, when she was first created, she didn't know that she was Ms. Marvel. She just like kept blacking out, and then there would be this like woman who was going around solving crimes and stuff, and so eventually, after a couple of issues, they figured out that wasn't working very well. So then they took the two personalities and put them together, and like we were talking about how Superman couldn't fly at first. He could just jump real high. She couldn't fly at first either. The power to fly was actually in her costume. But then after a few issues again, they decided, oh, that's not working real well. So they like, I don't know, put her up on a wall
Gentlemen,
and blast her.
This is a terrible metaphor.
Yes. Put her with some more rays and suddenly she could fly.
It is pretty bad when they have a female superhero who's powerful, but it's actually the powers are all in the clothes. There is a problem with that.
Her history is rife with metaphors that sort of make you wrinkle your nose, but she transcends them.
So what kind of power does she have now?
She metabolizes energy. She can fly and shoot rays from her hands. I just go with that.
And the rays go bang?
Yeah, they do. They're really hot. They blow things up. She can make them very
small. It's different because Cyclops doesn't have hot rays. He just has push rays.
Yeah. She can metabolize.
People always get that wrong.
She can fly. So you have to come up with like the hand wavy science reason that she can fly. Yeah. So I was like, well, she metabolizes energy and it expels it downward as heat, pushing her up much the same way an airplane works, which is interesting because she's a pilot. So I'm really proud of that one.
Can she go into space?
She can go into space. She cannot breathe in space, but she can hold her breath for a really long time.
Ironic.
So that's awesome. But she's sort of an adrenaline junkie. My conception of her is Carol Danvers as Chuck Yeager. So I have her kind of always thrill-seeking. And so one of her favorite things to do, which you mentioned earlier, she likes to fly up to the very edge of space and then just kind of hang out there until she runs out of oxygen and then falls downward. And then and then I've had an actual rocket scientist tell me my physics are really bad. So I had her as she hits the atmosphere, she absorbs she metabolizes the friction as energy, and that the heat of it.
Sure, yeah, I'm sure that's
wakes
fine.
Her up. This woman who cosplays as Carol is an actual rocket scientist, and she just sort of looked at me like this. She's like, "Oh." And on radio, what you should do is gestures, because people listening on the radio love that. That's awesome.
It's really not a good idea to let too much physics intrude into superheroes anyway. Didn't someone write a book about what if Superman was a real creature and if he had sex with Lois Lane?
Bad news for Lois.
Bad news for Lois. If she could somehow survive that.
There would be no super children, that's for sure.
Yes, that's right, because they would essentially punch their way out of the womb and it would be... that's a theory. Yeah. We're talking about fictional
characters.
Nothing
ever would get into the womb. It would be like a shotgun.
That's right. I know. It just can't work.
It was him, not me.
Yeah. But no, Carol's awesome. And she's beautifully flawed. She's frustrated. She has a short temper. And a real desire to do well in the world, to be a hero on all levels, to do right, and good, and to balance all of those things. And she's constantly failing. And I love that about her. And it's hard. She's in a world where, you know, she's not a big brain. She's like physically very powerful. So, you know, she's got like her friend has cancer and like, you can't punch cancer. You know, you can't fix that. If what you have is big biceps, it doesn't matter. You're still weak in the face of that. You can't punch a recession, you know? And she's frustrated by that and hurt and angry. And she just wants to make things better for those people in her life.
And you're writing Hawkeye at the moment, but it's kind of Hawkeye in his downtime. This is the guy with the bow and arrow from the right, Avengers movie, but this is him in his kind of slightly dingy apartment somewhere in Manhattan. Yeah. And
we figured it out. I figured it out. There's a real
building?
Yeah.
Whereabouts?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
People actually live there. It's in Bushwick.
Okay, Bushwick. Okay, that's where the hipsters live nowadays, isn't it?
It's somewhere, but yeah, it's not quite as, it's not the Bushwick of the Ghetto Boys, not to date myself with 90s gangster rap, but it's crawling out of its...
He has no superpowers to speak of. He's just a very skilled marksman.
Right.
How does he see the super dudes around him in the Avengers?
I think, you know those bumps that they put on the sides of the highway, so if you're drunk or you fall asleep at the wheel, you're like, I think he considers them his sort of moral guideposts on the road of life, and as he drifts too far one way or the next, Captain America or Thor will kind of gently guide him back towards the center of the lane. And
so they're more morally empowered than him as well, then. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I think, well, this is the thing, the kind of the problem of the book when you decide, okay, let's write Hawkeye, is why is he an Avenger? Why is he with a Norse god and, you know, the Steve Jobs robot suit guy and Frozen American Hero Man and the...
I totally want to write Frozen American Hero Man.
That's like the knockoff, like the bootleg, like you see it on a blanket, like being sold in a subway station. It's like $5 on DVD, shot on a cell phone.
But he's this guy with medieval weaponry.
Right. That's the thing, is why... I don't want to go too far into it, because I'll eventually be kind of giving away my own punchline. But yeah, that why do they let him here? Why is he one of them is sort of ultimately what the book is about for me, is why do they let the guy with the stick in the wire hang out? What makes him... Where the Saturday Night Live did that brilliant sketch where in the middle of the alien invasion, he's like, well, my arrows are out, I'm going home. And they're like, there's like 6,000 aliens. Like, yeah, and I shot 10 of them. You're welcome. I'm going home. Like, that's why do they let him hang out is kind of that's the joke. That's the book.
The characters you write for, particularly the big name characters like X-Men, the Avengers, and in other comic book companies, the idea of Superman and Batman, these are more than just simple comic book characters. These are multi-bazillion dollar bits of intellectual property that are owned by gigantic corporations. How much leeway are these corporations prepared to give you, the writer, or writers in general of these comics, when they hand over, they entrust you with these characters, Matt?
A surprising amount.
Yeah. I remember there's a fellow named Alan Moore who's pretty good, and he once wrote a comic called Swamp Thing, which sounds like, you know, like a Swamp Thing, and it is. And it was revolutionary, the stuff he did with it, the way he told these stories. And it was time, and eventually he left kind of at the height of his abilities in the book, and it had never been better, and it was time, and he decided to go. And somebody asked him why, and I'm paraphrasing, but he basically said, I wanted to tell stories about the environment, and the big muck monster kept getting in the way. And I feel like Marvel is particularly good at matching writers with properties who understand, if you're here to write Iron Man, if you're here to write the Avengers, it's not the place to do, you know, a hard-hitting expose on, you know, a human trafficking necessarily. It needs to be about Iron Man, it needs to be about the Avengers, etc. And they're really good at getting good work out of creative people, but I think they just trust us to understand what the job is. And if you want to tell a story about
the recession, find somewhere else to do or make find a way to make Thor be able to hit that recession with a hammer in a way that's sort of viscerally satisfying. But if you're telling a Thor comic, make it a Thor comic. If you're telling the Avengers, make it the Avengers. And I think they're very good at figuring out, you know, who to pair, how to pair us up and how to kind of get us going in a direction that, that produces work that isn't wildly off message or off brand necessarily.
One of the things that's annoying about superhero comics is that characters won't stay dead. They never stay dead. I went through that period of the X-Men in the early 1980s where the character of Phoenix turned into Dark Phoenix and she committed suicide, essentially, because in this kind of mentally chaotic state, she destroyed an inhabited planet. So she committed suicide on the moon, essentially.
By editorial fiat.
Yeah, that's right. And it's kind of worked as brilliant kind of soap opera, space opera, if you like. And it created so much sympathy and attention and the whole idea of moral consequence. She was back a couple of years later. And she's been dead and back again and dead and back again a couple of times, I think. So what's going to happen there with that? Isn't it so annoying to you that characters who are killed with all this fanfare, the death of Superman in the late 80s, there's been the death of Batman as well, they won't stay dead? Why kill them if they won't stay dead?
I got a thing. You got this? Or you want me to,
No, you go.
I got a thing. Of course, the only character that's ever going to stay dead in comics is Uncle Ben, because without Uncle Ben, there's no Spider-Man. But comics are never about the death. It's about the escape. People didn't go see Houdini because they wanted to see Houdini die. People went to go see Houdini because they wanted to see Houdini almost die, right? It's the resurrection. It's the escape from the... It's a death trap. It's not really death. How do they get out of it? Everybody knew they were going to bring Superman back. It was Superman. Of course they're going to bring him back. How is the question? How do you escape? You're upside down. You're handcuffed. You're in a straitjacket. And you're underwater. And there's piranhas at the bottom. How are you going to get out? That's what keeps us coming back to, like, superhero fiction especially, is we have to keep building these better, more exciting, more inescapable death traps and coming up with hopefully more ingenious ways for these characters to escape. But I think that's part of the charm and the appeal. On top of the very soap opera, you know, you reveal that, aha, but my evil twin was alive all along, and, you know, that kind of fun stuff. But I think we respond to this on some level because death is so very real to all of us. It's great to see people be able to escape it with verve and vigor and kind of wit.
And also, I think if you think of these stories as being one linear narrative, then it does become frustrating that, you know, if a character dies and comes back, you're like, but I have my story in order, and you're messing with my stories. But I tend to think that these characters are so iconic that, you know, the characters that don't catch on, the characters that are not particularly meaningful, that don't attach to that sort of lizard brain thing we were talking about earlier, those characters, when they die, those will totally stay dead. It's the ones that speak to us, that latch on to those places, that continually come back, and they continue to come back because we have more stories to tell about them. And I think this was a thing that, when people got very upset about the DC reboot. So this is a thing that happened a couple years ago now, I guess. Time flies. Where DC basically sort of ended their continuity and restarted everything.
So all the history that had accumulated over the last 60 years or so of villains, love lives, all that sort of thing, brought to an end and rebooted.
Yes, or exactly like 97% of it. I'm not sure. I'm not... completely certain I understand exactly how it worked, but that's the basic idea. And then and there were a lot of readers who were very angry and very sort of strangely scared about it, and they would come up to us at cons, and I don't even work for DC, but I did three issues of Supergirl pre-revamp, and I think that was why maybe I got this question so much, but people would come up and like want to hear my outrage at it, you know? And I really I can't bring myself to be upset about that, because the thing that I kept hearing was that now all of everything that I have in my long boxes, all these stories don't matter, right? They don't matter. This comes up a lot. But the thing is this, that stories only matter. Fiction only exists for the effect it produces on you. So the only thing that matters about that story is how it made you think, how it made you feel. If it taught you something or gave you a moment of humanity where you felt connected to this character or to someone else, that is the only thing that matters. when you start to glom
there, there is this trivia in Lanyap, when you start to
glom onto this other stuff, what you're doing is you're getting attached to the marketing. The notion that some of these stories matter because they're in continuity, or this one's out of continuity, blah, 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 blah. That's marketing. That isn't the thing. That's not what's important about fiction. What's important is that the story speaks to you, that the character feels real, right?
How did you come to comics, Kelly? When did you start reading?
I have picked up and put down comics so many times over the years, but
you're like a social smoker.
I know.
I only read comics when other people have them.
Yeah. When I was growing up, we lived, my father was in the Air Force, and so we lived on various Air Force bases all around the world, and it was at the time very big in military culture comic books, and I think that makes sense. I think if you think about it, like the people who are sort of drawn to service in that way, lower economic ranks are overrepresented in the military and a volunteer military, and so aspirational heroism and escape that are all basic to comics. It was a huge part of our culture. So and we didn't get American television, so my mom would buy them at the base Stars and Stripes and kind of dole them out to me. It was also the 1970s, and we had kind of a resurgence of the women's movement. And my mom used to give me Wonder Woman comics to kind of, you go, girl. Pretty sure she didn't read them.
How about you, Matt? How did you come to comics?
You know, I always remember them being around. I drew compulsively as a kid and started on a fine arts educational track. So I think they were all just kind of fuel on that fire. And I remember kind of newspaper strips and comic books always sort of being in the periphery. And I learned to read really young, and sort of just they were always a part of my life. And I was always, forever drawing and sort of keeping comics with me as I went, and telling stories with pictures and stuff.
I grew up in comics of the 1970s, which were all incredibly weird, or they were reprints of comics from the 1950s, which were the weirdest comics of all time, which became incredibly psychedelic and strange. Yeah. Superman with 9 different kinds of kryptonite, which all affected him differently, with big heads or
were you one of those kids? Like, I loved Classifications. Like, I was a kid who, like, make charts, you know, like, oh, like that whole Green Arrow thing with Green Lantern, sorry, Green Lantern. That with all of the different colored lanterns and those all
Green
being
Arrow,
like,
just slowly walks out of the auditorium.
I know. I would have loved that. That would have been so up my alley.
Given that you were doing a bunch of different things with your lives, how did you guys then meet up? Because you are a married couple, as I said before. How did you meet?
We met on the Warren Ellis posting board.
Comic book writer Warren Ellis.
You had this online connection, did you?
Yeah. Sort of, I lived in New York. He lived in Kansas City. We made each other laugh. Mm-hmm. So
how do comic book nerds flirt with each other? I've got to know.
In pictures.
Yeah,
there was. We would. We had threads on the Ellis forum.
Comic nerds do it sequentially.
Where were you living at the time, Kelly? Say.
I lived in Brooklyn.
And how about you, Matt?
I was in Kansas City, Missouri.
Oh man, right. So you're right in the
right
middle
where
of the
second drink service comes if you've ever flown across the country.
So, how did you then make the decision to see each other in person, so to speak?
Well, we flirted online first, and then Charlie Chu, who is now, because a lot of people from the Ellis Forum have gone on to have careers in comics. Charlie Chu is now an editor at Oni Comics, and he gave my IM address. I don't know, does AIM still exist?
It's now iMessage. But okay, we started to talk like off board and talk a lot, and then we started to call each other, and then it kind of got to a point where like we should meet, and this was sort of post 9/11,
like 9/11.
Literally, like this was like 9/26, and like airfares were crazy cheap. there was specifically a discount air carrier headquartered in Kansas City, and we could fly back and forth for less than $100 on like 48 hours notice. It was really easy to get for us.
So
you dated people in the city. You saw less than you saw me when we were dating.
Yeah.
So you flew to Kansas, or did you fly to
She flew out to me first.
And what happened when you arrived at the airport and seeing Matt for the first time?
Oh, this is great, actually. So I get there, and on the way there, I'm like, this is awesome. I'm either like, this is either the man of my dreams, or I'm going to get chopped up and left in a ditch.
And either way, I'm going to be the last man you see.
Yeah. And so, we had talked about all of these things. We'd like prepared for all of these contingencies. It had not occurred to me that he would not show up. Like, that one.
I think outside of the box.
Yeah. So
why didn't Matt show up?
Well, I get off the plane and I'm looking around. We had sort
first
of
off 40 minutes early.
Okay. All right. Well, my
40 minutes early.
So
amongst the incredibly anal of you who are always at the airport early, who amongst you is here 40 minutes early? One guy, liar. You, I believe. All right.
So my plane arrives a little early. And I get off the plane, and we had agreed, like, what we were going to wear. We talked about what we were going to wear, and I'm looking around to see if I see him, and we'd said he wore at the time a cowboy hat, and we'd said no cowboy hat, but there was a dude in a cowboy hat, so I kind of kept looking at the dude, and dude's looking at me like, lady, no. And,
because you're in Kansas with purple hair, essentially, or something like that.
Yeah, did I have...
Black, it was black then.
It was black hair then, but, So my bag had gotten lost. So I just started.
She was having an awesome Saturday.
Yeah. So I just started laughing because it was like, well, this is not going the way I thought, but good story. And so I'm about to go over to the ticket booth to see if I can. And I know the plane is turning around and going right back to New York. So I'm like, can I just get back on it? And then he walks up. And the first time I saw him, he was sweating bullets, and his shoulders were up at his ear, and he had his hand over his mouth like this.
Because I knew I had screwed up.
Yeah.
What had happened was I'd borrowed a friend's minivan to come pick her up. I didn't have a car at the time. And he had a bunch of stuff in the back that I didn't know about. like, oh, hey, here's a radio I can fix, or here's an old chair maybe I can do something with. It was a van. It's what you do.
Remember, right after 9/11.
It was right after 9/11, and every single car at the airport was being stopped. The drivers were being removed, and the cars were being searched top to bottom.
And you've got a van full of broken
electronics. What's all that electronic stuff back there? I have no idea. Do you have your registration? It's not my car. This license is from North Carolina. I know. How you doing, guys? So I not only burned through that 40 minutes she was early, but at least a good half hour as every inch of my friend's car is being searched. And it's sort of, I don't have a cell phone because it's only 2001. And
now I know you were...
It all worked out. It's okay.
It all worked out. You were heavily anticipating the arrival of Kelly Sue. How had you prepared your apartment or your house for Kelly Sue?
I literally threw everything away. Sheets, towel. A buddy of mine, because I didn't have a car, had to drive me to like Target, and I rebought everything. And he looked at me like, "You're insane!" Like I just like didn't want anything like anything that had at any point dwelled in like bachelor filth was going. Yeah. And I was terrified the whole weekend she was going to go out back and look at, for some reason, like, "Oh, I'll just throw this away," and look in the dumpster behind the building and see like, "Oh my God, somebody threw away like an entire apartment back here."
And I'm not a particularly jealous person. That's like, I have a great many character defects, but that's not a big one for me. But he only had like two coffee mugs. Like, who only has two coffee mugs?
The dude who just spent $600 rebuying his entire.
So, I knew that clearly the coffee mugs had been bought for like him and a chick. And I was kind of like, it kept bothering me. And so I decided, well, let me just put some sunshine on this. I'm going to confess that I'm having this weird thing. And so I was like, dude, I don't know what my deal is with my obsession with this coffee mug is, but like, I'm just saying I'm having a weird thing with the coffee mug.
But and then, I had bought it for her.
Now they're married, they've got several children, and they're in Australia, which is lovely.
The end.
The end. That's a happy ending. Before we go, I just want to quickly touch on the whole gigantic process of making comics, writing comics, the actual process of
In the last 3 minutes.
In the last 3 minutes, I want to ask you about the kind of script you write. to actually write a comic?
A comic book script is very much like a screenplay. So it begins. It's a letter to your artist. It begins. You know,
a letter to the artist.
Yeah. Well, I think of it as a letter to the artist, which is.
What we actually write is read ultimately by about 5 or 6 people at best. What you read is a fragment of what we actually write. And that's the stuff that we tell a letterer to put into the balloons. And even then we tweak and twist and poke until they tell us to stop.
Yeah. So you write something like the action opens here and this is what the building
page
looks
one,
like.
Panel one, wide shot. We see our hero riding over the horizon. She's backlit.
Or ultimately, or with, you know, when Stan Lee was told many years ago, hey, you're writing 8 comics, the only way he was able to do that was he created a style of writing which is now called plot style, which is he would say, okay, so on page 1, the Fantastic Four wake up. On page 2, they start to have breakfast, but then Dr. Doom comes in. Page 3 through 8, they fight. Page 9, we cut to Adelan, and the Inhumans are blah, blah, blah. He would write these kind of very broad strokes. The artist would break them down and draw. Then Stan would make up what the words are. So I more and more these days have a very hybrid style like that because I find that it gets much cooler stuff out of my artists. It makes it much more collaborative.
Yeah, the only book that I do that is Marvel or a plot style at all is Pretty Deadly, which is my creator-owned book, and that one is kind of a hybrid because I have a very close relationship with that artist. Yeah.
And just finally and very briefly, some people think that, you know, the reason why comic book heroes are kind of freshly relevant is they're kind of a harbinger of a human future, that they're kind of an indication of a post-human future we're kind of reaching towards. This is us in the future. What do you guys think of that?
Warren Ellis comics. I think that there are those among us who are really exceptionally gifted futurists like Ellis. And then I think those themes apply.
I'm not sure that I buy into like the singularity of it all, but I certainly think things are evolving and people are evolving and things are changing. We're going to continue to kind of grab our own evolution by the throat and make it do what we want.
Matt Fraction, Kelly Sue DeConnick, thank you so much.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.